welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rezac. This is the show that gives you insights and resources on how to live a more courageous life. We'll be looking at men, the current state of masculinity, and how to create a more inspiring narrative for all men. Welcome, and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. Well, I did something I rarely do on Base Camp these days. I turned an interview with an excellent guest into a two-parter. I've tried in vain to keep my episodes to 45 minutes or so. And in fact, in the early seasons, 30 minutes was the norm. Now, as you know, it is often 45 minutes on up to 60 minutes. However, I really don't want to go over an hour. And if I'm honest, I would love to get back to 60-minute episodes. But I'm following God's plan for both my guests and how long the episodes will be. In part one with my guest today, we get into the power of rituals and rites of passage, something that is near and dear to me, the power of homeschooling and unschooling, something more and more parents are looking into these days, and how humanity's enemy is using inversion tactics, including an inverted hero's journey, to capture the minds and hearts of our young people. I always love sitting around the fire with a bright mind, and today's guest is certainly one of them. Enjoy the episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone. Base Campers, I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today is Simon Essler. Simon is a committed defender of families and the lost art of free thought. He has been an actor, an ordained minister, and mindfulness entrepreneur, which has led him to become a professional content creator and independent filmmaker. His website, www.simonessler.com, hosts an array of films, series, and resources focused on leveraging the pressures of modern war to foster personal growth and collective resilience. Here is my interview with Simon Essler. All right. I am here with Simon Essler, homeschooling father, dad, army captain, filmmaker and writer, thought leader, Simon Essler. Simon, welcome to Base Camp for Men. It is great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm really glad to be here. I'm excited for this.
Me too. You know, I came across your writing. God dang, you're a good writer. I don't say that willy-nilly. I've just really gotten a lot out of your Substack. One of my other guests, it's escaping me now, recommended you. It might have been Pamela. Jess Arburn?
Yeah.
Yes, it was Jess Arburn, who I had on recently, and she pointed me towards you, and we connected. I started clicking on your writing, and man, oh man, you do such a great job with that. I just think you're helping a lot of people make sense of the important topics right now. So nice work. And then I found out you're a filmmaker. You've got these films and short documentaries and stuff. So super creative. And I was just really happy to get connected to you today. And I guess I just want to start by asking you, just give us a little bit about your background, like where you're from, where you grew up, where you live now, how many kids you have. I mentioned that you're a homeschooling dad. So how many of those guys you got around, and, you know, what do you do for work, to pay the bills?
Right. So I was born in Western Canada, out west in Alberta. So I was actually born in Calgary. You know, the contrast between where I was born and where I was raised is pretty strong now, considering what's happening to Canada. It's interesting, you know, watching Alberta kind of fight for a level of sovereignty that it hasn't until now. I think it's really amping up. And then living in Ontario and watching some of this woke mind virus sort of really show its face here most prevalently in a lot of the places in Canada. So I think about that often, that, you know, I came from the western side of Canada, but grew up on the eastern side, and how different they are. But that being said, you know, as I was growing up, I was in a town called Oakville most of my childhood, and it's one of the wealthiest towns in Canada. I think one of the top wealthiest places in the world. So I grew up around a lot of crazy, crazy wealth. And that was an interesting experience for me, because it was, on the one hand, really kind of a peaceful place to grow up. We were very free, and I had some really great social connections. I had a very healthy social life growing up, and that was awesome. But at the same time, it was kind of a Gap commercial. There was a surreal aspect to it. And eventually, you know, when I was a teenager, I got really, really sort of bitter about this. And I ended up leaving the high school that I was going to for a semester and took a semester of high school in an adjacent town in Burlington. And this was a chance to sort of pull back and get a larger view of what was going on. And because I grew up, you know, in this particular circumstance, I got drawn into some of the leftist ideas of, you know, anti-capitalism and anti-consumerism and, you know, anti-war sentiments. I got very big into Adbusters magazine.
Oh, yeah. So I love that magazine. Yeah.
Yeah. And I still, you know, I look back with a lot of fondness still because they articulated the mental environment.
Yeah.
For me, they were their first source in my life to say, hey, there's a mental environment and it can be manipulated. And that was an incredible revelation that was very helpful for me and has probably, you know, carried me into the work I'm doing now. But I was, you know, of course, a little more caught up in things that I'm now more critical of. Mm-hmm. But some of those foundations of the, you know, awareness of the mental environment, awareness of media and propaganda, they really stuck with me. After high school, I went to theater school and I studied. I majored in theater and I studied within a stream of theater at York University called Collective Creation. It was all about collectively creating theater. There was about 20 of us in a class and they were teaching us how to collectively devise theater pieces where everyone shares in the writing, the directing, the acting, the creating, and what that's really like. And it was a really incredible experience because there were certain philosophies about art and life that I was introduced to there that have informed everything that I have done since. One of the main ones being that as an artist, you know, it is your restrictions that free you. And you have to be in right relationship with restriction for your creativity to be expressed. And they even showed us this in the way that they had us audition to get into the program. When I had to audition to get in, we had to do a 1-minute monologue that had a kiss, a death, a dance. All the text had to be lifted from magazines and novels. And you had to have one prop that you used as three different things. And so that philosophy really carried for me. And I'm still a theater performer today. I do comedy theater here in Toronto. I'm actually rehearsing for a new show that I'm opening in October. I have a rehearsal tonight, in fact. But
that's awesome.
But outside of that, this philosophy of the restrictions will free you has really, really stuck with me. So in moving sort of past acting, I went into some other things. I worked as a personal support worker for many years with people, adults and children on the autistic spectrum, did very mindfulness-based personal support work. I helped one family sort of create a homeschooling program for their autistic son. So I was in that space for quite a while. I launched a mindfulness-based business called Thunderheart Guidance, and that was about giving one-on-one mindfulness and meditation packages to people. So some of it was just, you know, people within my network, but some of it was with high-level CEOs, very sort of stressed out 1%ers that I would sometimes work with who were looking to go really deep into meditative practices. And from there, I became inspired to become a life cycle celebrant. And this was sort of on my path to becoming ordained as a minister. So a life cycle celebrant, this is with the life cycle, the Life Cycle Celebrant Foundation and Institute. And basically they train people in the art of custom ceremony creation. And that education was focused on looking at the broad history of ceremony and ritual throughout the human story and what elements have always been present so that we could become masters at gathering the elements for a particular ceremony and, you know, inputting into it the rituals that are authentic to whoever we're working with. So one of the ways that was looked at was through wedding ceremonies, you know, when you had, let's say, families coming together that were of different religious orientations, they would often want a ceremony that authentically reflected the different religions of both families. And so they would want something of a custom creation.
That's interesting.
So, you know, it was an incredible experience because what I ended up doing was really getting deep into the fact that all ceremonies, especially rites of passage, contain within them the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. This was in one of the foundational concepts we were given, that there aren't any rite of passages in any of human history that don't have the basic elements of the hero's journey within them.
Yep.
And that really fascinated me because I saw the impact myself. I would create these ceremonies. And what I did, what we were trained to do, was to create a questionnaire for the couple that asked them about their story, from who they were alone to who they were together and how it happened. And once they each filled out the questionnaire separately, it was my job to take the elements of their story and weave their hero's journey into an authentic ceremony that reflected who they were. And it was so indicative of how inauthentic ceremony and ritual and rites of passage have become in our culture at large, because people were always floored. They were always shocked when they experienced a ceremony that was authentically reflective of the people they had come to celebrate. And they would see this beautiful ceremony that was built of the pieces of their life story together. And just every single one that I did was, it involved people being kind of blown away. And I really don't mean that in terms of, you know, my skill level. Like, I do feel I was good at it, but I really think it was more that people were always prepared for these very dry, meaningless ceremonies where people just perform the traditions that they perform and everyone's just trying to get to the good part, which is the food and the drinking and the dancing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you pointed on something that we've touched on in the show a number of times, especially in the beginning episodes, in that, and I think I like everything you said about it, that people are starved for ceremony, ritual, and myth. So when they get it, like, you're good at putting it together and creating this arc of the hero's journey, people are always transformed by that. And I think I see the young people today, like, my listeners know I went through many rituals and ceremonies to arrive where I'm at. But one of the most important ones as a man is I went through the Mankind Project's New Warrior training, which is a beautifully crafted hero's journey. Every man goes through 65 processes over 3 days. And it's, you know, you're really going through it on every level you can imagine, using myth, using your own, you know, strengths and weaknesses, your gold and your shadow. But when I came out of it, I was a totally different man than when I entered, you know, on Friday night. I came out Sunday, completely different. But it's esoteric, right? People don't know about it. And I look at, I don't know if you have sons. I have one son, and I wonder, there's not enough hero's journeys. There's not enough mythical ritual space for him laid out before him. So it's like, as a parent, you have to ask, I think, how do I help create this? What if he never does a training like the one I did? Is he going to be, does that mean he's void of all ritual and initiation into manhood? You know, how do I do that? And so I guess I was going to ask this towards the end, but since you introduced it, I thought we'd flip the order and just give you a chance. Like, how do you, you know, you have children. How many children do you have?
I have two boys, six and nine.
Yeah, and so you're early on, but as they get older, how do you construct something where they go through a transformation and come out? You know, like the Israelis. You might not agree with this method of using myth or using ritual, but like the Israelis, there's a demarcation. When you're done with high school, you serve 2 years. You have to get in shape. You have to serve something that's more. You can't just look at TikTok videos after high school and fart around with your friends. You have to serve the nation and serve something greater than yourself. And I agree with that. I wouldn't mind seeing that. I don't like that they have mandatory vaccinations for a million things in the military, which is like, okay, I don't know if I want that for my son. But I agree with them noticing that, look, young people, when they come out of high school, they need some sort of ritual and initiation to indicate to themselves internally that they have crossed over into adulthood and they're going to serve society, right?
Yeah, this is a really, really important aspect of what we're dealing with. The simple answer to how we address the lack of initiation and rites of passage for youth today is that as parents, we need to get to know our children deeply enough that their hero's journey is clearer and clearer to us as we deepen our relationship with them, because that's what avails us to being of service in that way. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the ways that I look at this is that we want to become legacy keepers, that we are born legacy makers. So a lot of this just happens naturally, you know, whether you want it or not, you're creating some kind of legacy. And as a parent, you kind of have to accept that your actions are echoing not just into your children's lives, but into a number of generations ahead of you. Mm-hmm. So we're all automatically legacy makers. And I think what distinguishes a legacy maker from a legacy keeper is the conscious awareness of that which you're maintaining, and the capacity to accept responsibility for affecting generations, you know, seven generations into the future, and for having a mindset that is, you know, tied into this idea of being a legacy keeper. I look at the opportunity I have with my children as one that is rich with information about their unique hero's journey. Mm-hmm. You know, in particular, our family happens to use human design to do that. And I don't want to sort of go too far into the human design rabbit hole, but it is a means of just really looking at the unique nature of the child and understanding where they have their nature, meaning those parts of themselves that they were born with that have always been there and that are always just kind of, they're going to be there. And as a parent, you know, you see this, you see the qualities that your child had when they were breastfeeding, you know, the particular ways of being they had, the particular ways of struggling and expressing themselves. You see those parts of them that were there right from day one. Sure. As they get older. So there's those parts of them that is their nature that is reliable and sturdy. And then you see the other aspects of them, you know, which is their nurture, the parts of themselves that are open to being conditioned by you and the world at large. And as a parent, you really have the opportunity to get clear about their nature and their nurture. And their nurture, this space in them that is available to the world and the conditioning of the world, if you can understand that deeply, then you can really, first of all, protect them correctly, because each child needs to be protected according to their innocence. That is to say, where they are uniquely vulnerable, not just innocence as a generic concept.
Right.
So,
you know what's funny, Simon, is you said they show their thumbprint, you know, early on, like what makes them really unique. And my son, he's 17, and you cannot rush him. It doesn't matter how hysterical anybody gets that we're going to be late. He just breathes nice and easy, and he just takes his time. And he took 36 hours to come out. You know, like it was from the beginning. It was like, I'm not rushing out. I'm just going to take my time. And that's how he is. And so you have to honor that. There's so much to be said about really understanding your young person's rhythms and what makes them super unique and how they perceive things. So anyways, go ahead. I didn't want to forget that part.
No, it's such a great point, because it emphasizes something really important, which is that if we don't pay attention to the parts of our children that are always going to be there, we run the risk of being against who they are, right? If we are chronically frustrated with these parts of our children, that's just who they are. Even if it's, you know, because sometimes children have elements to their personality, they're not entirely socially acceptable, that, you know, that need a nuanced understanding. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the trap. When you don't really understand who your child is, you might end up against who they are. And that can really lead to some damaged relationships. So I think we have an opportunity to look at our children more deeply now with the growth in homeschooling and unschooling. You know, this is a huge boon in the sense of parents getting to know their children more deeply. And there's nothing that will protect children more than just parents learning how to have these deeper relationships with their children. In terms of rites of passage, you know, I have a questionnaire that I created with my partner, Amanda, and it's called Legacy Keepers. And it's a questionnaire that we designed for parents that is structured according to the hero's journey. And it invites parents to study their child's unique hero's journey and to keep this questionnaire as a kind of resource to be able to build rites of passage down the road. And I think that's one of the ways we want to be looking at it. You know, your child is the hero in their story, and finding how that's true for them, it gives you the opportunity to give them the rites of passage at all the different points in life. And sometimes that's not a big deal, like a bar mitzvah where you gather the whole family and create this massive event. Sometimes it's smaller. So for example, yeah. you know, I created a rite of passage when my son, my oldest son, had his first sleepover. And it was very simple. We just, we made a list of all the things that he likes to use in a 24-hour cycle. We made a checklist.
That's great.
And then we sat down and decided, hey, which things do you want to make sure you have with you at your friend's place that you normally have? And he went through this list and the things that he wants to bring. And, you know, I really saw that the creation of this rite of passage that caused him to reflect and consider things more deeply and frame this as a rite of passage, I watched him go deep into himself.
That's great.
And come out and say, wow, this is my first sleepover. And it gave it depth and meaning, as opposed to me just packing his bag for him and being like, have a good time, son.
Right.
Just that, even those small kinds of rites of passage,
yeah,
over the years become very meaningful. And that's the kind of legacy keeper mindset that I believe can be nourishing. And of course, I do also believe that coming into adolescence and the move from childhood to adolescence, and then again from mm-hmm. adolescence to adulthood, these times in life have inherent instability in them.
Yeah.
And the risk is that the suffering that is going to come to your child is given no meaning.
Right, right. One of the things that I'm noticing about my 17-year-old, and he's telling his mother and I what kind of initiation he's looking for in how he talks. So, for instance, when it comes to money, he has this immense pride of that he works and goes to school and he pays his own way. Like, he does not like it. Like, there's other boys. I coach a soccer team. I have 18, 17-year-olds on my team, right? And they're all unique, to your point, right? But my boy, Lucas, he doesn't want you paying for stuff. He doesn't want you sending him with cash for lunch. He doesn't want you paying if he bangs up his car, right? He wants to handle all that. And sometimes my wife's like, oh, Lucas, you know, let us help you with that. And you can see that he's really annoyed at that notion. Like, knock it off. Like, I got it, you know? And then I have other boys on my soccer team. They're like, oh, dude, I'd let you pay for my, you know, XYZ. I don't have an issue with that at all. So the initiations are different for each of the, you know, young people growing up. But mine is telling me I really thrive when I've got my finances handled. That's me adulting. That's me. I'm being initiated into the world of, you got to handle your stuff. And I see that. And so my wife in particular is really backed off of like trying to send him with money or let us pay for that. I'm like, he doesn't want us doing that. And I think if we keep insisting, I think it's just really annoying to him.
You know, you're pointing out, I think, what is the precipice of sort of parenting and rite of passage right now. So mm-hmm. the old role of rites of passage, when we look at it through the more traditional religious lens, was to sort of see your child as this blank slate, this sort of empty container, and then you perform the rite of passage to install in them the traditions and dogma that are mm-hmm. necessary, you know, mm-hmm. that are part of that religious body of material.
Yeah.
And that's really what it was looked at as. It was just a moment to install the correct operating system into the child. It had nothing to do with seeing who they are. And I think this is where rites of passage and homeschooling and unschooling, I think this is where they have the opportunity to meet, because we now have parents who are spending way more time with their children and getting to see them more deeply. This is where we can bring rites of passage back and allow the rite of passage to be born of who they are. And the example you give is really interesting, because you can see that your child has an inherent value system, mm-hmm. and it does not have to do with something that you installed in your son, you know, in this way of them being a blank slate and getting this value system installed. Part of the nature that each individual carries is that there are inherent values, things that they value that just have to do with who they are. Now, if someone with those kinds of, you know, material values in terms of being materially independent was raised by someone who is sort of anti-materialist or anti-capitalist, you know, that might be seen as bad. Like the ideology of the parent conflicting with the value system of the child is a risk if the parent is of the mindset that they need to take their value system and install it in the child.
Right.
So seeing our children for who they are sometimes means that they may have a value system that just isn't yours. And I think that's a hangup that we're poised. We're in a position in history when a lot of parents could be letting go of that and making peace with that and sort of evolving parenting into this next level where so much of the guidance and support that you can give your child is just born of seeing them very, very deeply. What kind of frustrates me about the current educational model and the mainstream way of seeing children is the idea that they need to be correctly manipulated by adults to make it in the world. And I think children, as they grow up, are giving us such an abundance of information about what they need that yeah. goes entirely unseen that I it looks kind of crazy from my lens now being in this space where I'm with my children every day and I'm getting to know them very deeply. And it's so simple in that, you know, what they need educationally and what their values are, all of it is right there if you're just spending enough rich time with them.
Yeah.
Now, that's not an easy thing to overcome for all families. Right. I've created a unique situation for myself, but I do see the opportunity to move things in the direction of both honoring individual children more than we ever have in history, but also figuring out how to create legacies. And to me, the evolution of legacy in terms of seeing the child for who they are and building rites of passage according to who they are is that you can then see where within them they're capable of carrying a legacy, that there is something you could pass on, but it has to fit who they are as beings. And so the legacy that they're going to carry, of course, it's going to be part of who your family sort of is together to an extent, but it also is only going to work to the extent that it fits with their unique nature and the path that they have inherently sort of built within them.
And what you said too is when you look at, I'm sure it's the same thing up in Canada as it is in America, the indoctrination, the Marxist indoctrination that's happening in the government schooling, all the things we're talking about, it is anemic on the level of soul, on the level of resonance with a hero's journey, on the resonance of myth, on the resonance of what it means to be an American or be a Canadian. Like, they've stripped all of the things that have that depth and that this is what I am. This is what I am in my core, and this is how I intersect with the most important myths and history and people that I'm around. They've stripped that all the way off and replaced it with this nonsense. And then they've just jammed it down the throats. They've created this anemic curriculum, which is not even teaching the kids the basics of reading, writing, and critical thinking. It's all been replaced with feeling and who's oppressed, who's the oppressor. Let's spend all of our time doing that, which has nothing to do with myth, has nothing to do with a real hero's journey. They, I think, you know, without being too, you know, conspiratorial or however you want to say it, this education that a lot of the kids are exposed to, it is not out for them to thrive, to have depth in their soul, regardless of your religious background, just, you know, to be steeped in a myth and a tradition where the kids walk with their heads up about who they are, where they're from, what matters to them, where they can articulate it, where they can think through things in a critical thinking way, where they're not, everything's based on offending people and, oh my God, I'm so offended. You used the wrong pronoun, this made up thing from a week ago that I'm basing all my identity on. You know, it to me, after a while, using a lens that I see it through now, it is so gross and shammy that they are creating this generation that just can't think their way out of a paper bag. They've been so indoctrinated. And you know, when you and I went through, you know, I was a liberal for a long, long time. So I, you know, this whole tolerant liberal thing, I was on board with it, right? But they have taken it way too far, and they have a complete disregard for future generations. In fact, they want them neutered. They want them neutered on a spiritual level. And if, you know, this wake-up call does not get through to parents to pull them out of government schools, they are in very, very stark danger. Both on a physical level, because they're pushing this change gender thing, so much, but also on a spiritual level where they're just being taught nonsense and they're hoping that parents don't catch on. That's a big rant, but it kind of intersects with some of the macro stuff we're going to talk about, but I wanted to give you a chance just to talk about, you know, the what you saw in schools that had you start to homeschool and start to maybe get into more of the macro of what you're seeing right now.
Well, I was conspiratorial enough before I was a father that my children have never entered a public school and probably never will.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah,
we were unschoolers from day one. We were never going to go that path. Mm-hmm. So Amanda and I were in that place from the beginning, which is kind of cool because we have like a unique experiment where we have children who have been totally unschooled from day one. And the results of that have been quite beautiful. One of the sort of cooler stories that I have is that my eldest son taught himself to read, that he was a kid who did not want to be taught. Anytime we would try to teach him anything overtly as a child, he would swat us away. He would say, stop doing that. To the point that he would watch Dora the Explorer and Bo on the Go, these two kids' shows where the protagonist of the show is inviting the kids to do it, you know, to do activities, saying, come on, join me. Let's go like do this dance or whatever. And my son used to sit at the TV and go, no, stop telling me what to do.
He's sovereign, because man. Yeah.
The sovereignty. I mean, and he has always known who he is. And he's always been very firm in that he is going to learn things the way that is correct for him. Yeah. And so eventually we woke up to that after us not seeing it correctly. Eventually we woke up to that and we backed off, and lo and behold, you know, he taught himself to read, and we don't know what he did to do that. Mm. Right. This is one of the mysteries I've learned about, you know, studying childhood education, is that one of the primary things that you want a child to retain in the educational experience is deep learning. But deep learning is mysterious, because deep learning, it actually happens in the depths. They don't quite understand what's going on. But what qualifies deep learning is that the child can take the knowledge of something that they've learned and they can apply it to multiple different domains in their life with ease. That's one of the greatest characteristics of something that has gone through the deep learning process. But again, they don't quite understand what happens within a child, so that eventually that knowledge becomes a multi-domain skill set for them. So the fact that deep learning has this kind of mystery, I kind of love, because it really reflects my son's story where, you know, he just sat with books on his own. He just sat, and it's not that we didn't read to him. Like, we would read to him when he asked us, but there was no like learning through phonetics and pointing out words. He could always tell when we were doing even a hint of that, he would shut it down. He knew.
Oh yeah.
Always knew. Yeah. So he sat, he looked at books for hours, and then one day he just was fine and he was reading on his own. And this was just something he took care of himself. So that's sort of my experience of, you know, childhood education. My direct experience is that the systems of control that people believe children need to learn are maniacal. So I looked into the history of the public schooling system. And so before, it's important that people understand that before this, the neo-Marxist push arrived in our classrooms like it is today, you know, the roots of the schooling system were very kind of anti-human. They were brought over from Prussia, you know, from what became the Nazi movement. And the philosophy that was brought here into Canada and America from these Prussian educational models, it was a philosophy that denied the existence of human free will, mm-hmm. and that essentially saw humans as these soulless automatons to be controlled. These were the philosophies of the people that put together what's now understood as operant conditioning. And operant conditioning is just the basic idea that you control human beings by using punishments and rewards. You mm-hmm. threaten them and you bribe them. And that's what the school model is, right? You threaten the kid with the F, you bribe them with the A, and you try to get them to do what they're supposed to do. And it's mm-hmm. all about manipulation and control. So it's very important that people understand these are the roots of the public schooling system. They were already there. Now, of course, you know, we went through the system and we can see that obviously we didn't suffer in the way that a lot of kids are suffering today. So yes, there's been an escalation, but the reason that escalation has been allowed to happen, in my opinion, is because of some of these corrupt foundations that really weren't being properly acknowledged for what they were. Now, the escalation in terms of the neo-Marxism, you know, it is an interesting turn because it has within it, to me, elements that are a kind of inverted hero's journey. And I think inversionism is an interesting pattern when we look at what in our society is being inverted, you know, morally, mm-hmm. in terms of cultural values. You have this pattern of things being totally inverted, of the sort of Judeo-Christian model that was sort of foundational and was normative is being inverted in all these areas of our society. So that is countercultural in a way that is overtly satanic, you could say, just in the basic philosophy of inversion and Satanism challenging the natural order. And I don't mean that in a moral panic way, more in an analytical way. And one of the clearest examples that I found of this inversion is the way in which the gender affirmative model that, as you pointed out, is one of the actual physical dangers surrounding children today, because the school is acting as these gateways into the gender affirmative medical model. The stages of the gender affirmative model from beginning to end mimic the hero's journey and mimic a rite of passage, but it's an inverted rite of passage. It's an inverted hero's journey. So you have the child entering a turbulent, difficult, and stressful time in their life. You know, you have this a preteen or a teen girl, and she's approaching the precipice of womanhood. And so she enters this strange and uncomfortable time. Now, she's surrounded by some very strange cultural influences. On the one hand, there's a version of feminism that is being handed to her by people like Beyonce and Miley Cyrus. And it overtly states that hypersexuality is a form of feminism, that hypersexuality is a form of freedom for women. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, this is something that I touched on a bit in my film Cut. There's actual articles that say Beyonce is all feminists need. And, you know, 2016 shows us that Miley Cyrus is the only feminist we need. This is being said to girls directly. Now, on the other hand, they have the countercultural element, the neo-Marxist element of this that says, actually, that gender, you know, those gender norms are all super oppressive. And the way we can rise up is actually being non-conformists when it comes to gender and identity. And the girls are given this path out of womanhood. And so they're given these sort of two awful choices. Now, the normal hero's journey is that you're pulled into a strange new world, right? You're brought into this place that's kind of dark and strange and unfamiliar. And so we have this girl being brought in to this dark, strange, and unfamiliar place. But now she's surrounded by guides who are telling her that she was born in the wrong body, mm-hmm. And that she can change her name. And so we have rituals are performed. She's given a new name. She's given a new identity. She's given new pronouns. And once this happens, all of a sudden she's celebrated in these new ways, and she's called stunning and brave. And then if she moves further along the path, and actually is given the puberty blockers or is given the hormone therapy, this is then celebrated again, and there's an actual physical transformation. And the further this goes, the further you have this mimicking of the hero's journey. And so what ends up happening is a girl comes out the other side of this. She has a double mastectomy. She's infertile from all the hormone treatments and injections. And she's being celebrated and applauded and being told she's stunning and brave. And now she's supposed to bring that back into the world. And in the process of being brought back into the world, she's told also, you're in a nightmarish culture war and you're the target and there's a trans genocide, but congratulations on who you are now.
Yeah, you know, it's funny as you were saying that, I was thinking, inverted hero's journey. It reminded me of kind of Hansel and Gretel a little bit, where the innocent child is out in the woods where he or she thinks that there's a sweet, woman or a sweet grandmother approaching her, telling her where to go, when really it's a wolf, and it's the wolf of transgenderism, who's actually a villain in the story, but looks like a guide telling them, because it looks like the terrain that they're about to go, like to your point, is full, you're going to be magical. You're going to be a unicorn. Everyone's going to celebrate you. Look, there's all these wonderful people celebrating your transformation on this hero's journey, but it's a wolf. It's meant to eat the child. It's meant to destroy any kind of future. It's meant to confuse them so they don't know which way to go. The wolf steps in between the parents so that the parents can't even help the child navigate that dark night of the soul, that the wolf is like, because it looks like a friend, because it looks like somebody pointing towards magic and unicorns, and you're going to get a standing ovation as soon as you go on that path over there. Forget what your parents are saying. It's so gross.
Well, I hope you enjoyed part one with Simon Essler. In part two, which we'll do next week, we get into fifth generation warfare, the anti-children, anti-innocence culture that we find ourselves in, and is this by design? We also cover the taboo topic of pedophilia and what sort of future is all this leading to. Thank you, base campers, and we'll see you around the fire next week. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rezac, and you're listening to Base Camp for Men.